Hi, it's so great to be with you and to be together and to be, what better thing could we be doing today than thinking about and getting to know our God better? I think the answer to that question is nothing. We could be doing nothing better. There may be other things that feel more pressing, but it is a wonderful thing. Indeed, we'll spend eternity doing it. But what value is there in talking about things that God can't do? I have occasionally, there's a book, I've seen one or two, if you've got it, and I know it's on the bookstall, by this title that I wrote, and occasionally people come up to me and say, when I first saw it, I thought it was heresy. So, why talk about what God can't do? Well, come with me, if you would, to Psalm 121. And this is not something so much that God can't do as that he doesn't do, but it's a start and it sort of helps us in our thinking. So I'm going to read the whole of Psalm 121 because it's not very long. Give me a moment to turn it up. Sorry, from time to time we will sort of move around in the Bible together today, but I'll try not to wear your fingers out too much. So Psalm 121, a song of ascents. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. A song of ascents. These are the songs that the people would sing on their way to Jerusalem. As they were going to celebrate the festival, they would sing these psalms together as a way of kind of encouraging each other on what was a hot and difficult and often dangerous journey. Until I visited Jerusalem in 2018, I really had no idea what the surroundings were like, but it is rugged. And Jerusalem is on top of what feels like really quite a serious hill. I mean, it's a mountain, right? Mount Zion. And as the people sort of travel through the wilderness, and through the sort of mountain passes to get there, you can imagine sort of trekking there on foot, there is danger. Danger from lawless people, danger from wild animals, danger from the elements, the sun, the heat. And so to keep their spirits up and to remind themselves why they were going where they were going and why they could have faith that they would get there safely, they would sing these songs to each other on the journey. And Psalm 121 contains a really interesting little detail. He who watches over you will neither slumber nor sleep. One of the things that means that God's people can feel safe and know themselves secure is something that God won't do. He will not sleep. In other words, he's always watching. He's always there. He's always paying attention. He doesn't have a day off. He doesn't take a sabbatical. He is always on. Always looking out for his people. Always protecting them. Always caring for them. He who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. Now, if you turn back to Psalm 3, the Psalms begin in a really interesting way, don't they? Psalms 1 and 2 provide a kind of introduction to the whole book, a sort of vision of reality, that true life, true abundance comes in hearing and doing the word of God, meditating on God's law day and night, Psalm 1 verse 2, and in obedience to God's king, Psalm 2, which ends verse 12, kiss the sun or he'll be angry and your way lead to your destruction, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. The sort of fundamental fact of reality is that you either take refuge in God or you better seek refuge from God. And actually the only refuge from God is in God. He rules over everything. It is foolishness to live as if he was not king and as if his king would not triumph. And then Psalm 3 begins the rest of the book of Psalms, if you like, which take that view of reality and apply it to the struggles and the rigors of real life as we live it in this fallen world. And it's really striking to me that the first of those psalms is a psalm of complete anxiety, well, that comes from a position of complete anxiety. David is being pursued by his own son Absalom, after whom we're told all Israel had gone. Absalom has won over the people. He's got the army at his beck and call. David and a few followers are fleeing on foot, fleeing overnight to try to get safety, to get away from Jerusalem, and to get to a place where Absalom won't get to them. David is fleeing for his life. He's spending a night under the stars trying to get safety. You sort of get a sense of his state of mind, don't you, in verse 1. Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. But you, Lord, are a shield around me, my glory, the one who lifts up my head. I call out to the Lord, and he answers me from his holy mountain. I lie down and sleep. I wake again, because the Lord sustains me. I'll not fear, they thousands assail me on every side. I think in terms of verse 5, David is perhaps particularly astonished about the second bit of that description of his night. He says, I lie down and sleep, I wake again because the Lord sustains me. Every time he goes to bed, every time he lays down, he thinks, I might not wake up in the morning. Absalom might catch up. You know, I could die. The fact that he wakes again is a huge surprise to him. But if you've ever been in a really pressured situation, if you've ever had, life really kind of encircle around you and that sort of sense that you don't know the way out, I wonder whether the beginning of verse 5 is the really surprising thing to you. It's the surprising thing to me, I think. He says, I lie down and sleep. I mean, it's almost the sort of most obvious thing to happen when you're under pressure, when you're under stress, is that you can't sleep. You spend a sleepless night. You know, sleepless nights become a kind of way of talking about experiencing stress, about not being able to sort of manage your situation. But David says, I go to sleep at night. Why? Because he's so confident in the God who doesn't sleep. God watches over him. God protects him. So he knows that he can put his head on the, well, it's probably not a pillow, is it? As he's fleeing in the wilderness. But he can lay his head down and close his eyes and know that his protection doesn't come from his own wakefulness, his own brain sort of restless striving to come up with a solution for his problems. He can rest because his protection comes from the God who answers from his holy mountain. So the people going up the holy mountain, they console themselves with the remembrance that God does not slumber, does not sleep. David sleeps because God doesn't. So that's really why I entitled these sessions and entitled the book 12 Things God Can't Do and Why They Should Help You to Sleep at Night. I'm not saying God can't sleep. He doesn't. That's not one of the 12. But there's something that God doesn't do that actually offers us rest, real rest, in a tumultuous world. The God who doesn't sleep guarantees that it is safe for me to sleep. I can put my head on the pillow. I can close my eyes and know that even when I'm not alert, even when I can't protect myself, he is reigning. He is watching. Nothing is hidden from him. You're never more defenseless than when you're asleep, are you? But you're not defenseless because God is watching. And it's my hope and my prayer that actually as we look at who God really is and the things that he can't do, that might actually genuinely help us, not only with sleep, you know. And just disclaimer, I totally recognize that there are forms of insomnia that are physical in their basis. You know, I'm not for a moment saying if you're struggling to sleep at night, that's a sign that you don't have enough or adequate faith or anything like that. Please don't mishear what I'm saying. But actually knowing and trusting God does grant us a deep restfulness in our lives. We're not in control. We're not in charge. You know, the world does not rest on what you can do. It rests on him. And actually learning to trust him, it may help you sleep at night. It really might. And you know, I've seen one or two of you do have the book. I tell the story at the beginning of the book of a church weekend where I gave these talks, and someone came up to me. We started on the Friday night. And someone came up to me on the Saturday morning and said, "You're in trouble." And I sort of, you know, it's a fairly typical experience for me. And I said, "Oh dear, why is that?" She said, "Well, I nearly didn't make it here this morning." I thought, "Well, that's not really my fault then, is it?" And she said, "My husband died a couple of years ago, and I haven't slept through the night since that day. And I woke up this morning to hear knocking at my door." She said, I've never woken up later than 5 o'clock since he died. But, you know, it was time to leave and someone was at the door and I was still asleep. She said, it really works. So it really can make that sort of difference, I think, to actually just be able to say, "Lord, I'm in your hands. And I know I'm safer there than anywhere else." But God can't do. Is that right? I mean, we all know the song, don't we? My God is so big, so great and so mighty, there's nothing that he cannot do. So, I mean, maybe the people who came up to me and said, "Hang on, that book sounds like heresy." Maybe they're right. But of course, that children's song is very helpful in reminding us of God's bigness. But it may not be the most philosophically precise thing that you'll ever encounter in your life. You know, sort of atheists, apologists sort of press into that and they think, well, if what you believe about God is that he is omnipotent in the sense that there is nothing that's impossible for him, well, okay, let's try a thought experiment, they say. And I seem to remember that in The God Delusion, Richard Dawkins uses this very example. You know, the question is posed, can God create a rock that is too heavy for him to lift? Can God create a rock that is too heavy for him to lift? Your God can do anything, right? God's omnipotent. Can he make a rock that's too heavy for him to lift? Oh. Well, that's a really interesting question. If you mean by omnipotence, by the idea that God has all power, that he can do anything, then your first reaction has got to be to a question that begins, can God? Presumably you think, well, the answer to that question has to be yes. But if God creates a rock that's too heavy for him to lift, he's created a situation in which there's something he can't do. So you lose both ways. If you say, no, he can't do that, your God's not omnipotent. The omnipotent God doesn't exist. There you go. That saved you a lifetime of wasted devotion. But if you say he can create a rock that's too heavy for him to lift, you're saying, there's something he, at least in theory, can't do. Dawkins sort of chuckles to himself smugly and you turn the page and think, that's irritating, but I don't know what to do about it. Except that the idea of God being omnipotent, which is just two Latin words shoved together to mean all-powerful, able to do anything, the Christian belief that God is omnipotent does not mean God can do everything in that sort of, if you pose the question, can God, the answer must be yes kind of way. Because the Bible talks about all kinds of things that God cannot do explicitly. So, for instance, 2 Timothy 2:13, God cannot deny himself. We'll come back to 2 Timothy at the end of today, or if we don't get to the end of the handout, which is a distinct possibility. I'm not even going to say what obviously follows from that. The Bible's clear. There are things God can't do. He cannot lie. He cannot die. He cannot deny himself. So omnipotence doesn't just mean God can do anything. What it really means is that whatever he wills to do, he can do without any feasible opposition. There is nothing in the creation that can hinder God's will. Whatever he chooses to do, whatever he wills to do, he can and will do. I mean, even Meatloaf has things that he recognises it's best if you can't do them, doesn't he? I would do anything for love, he says, but I won't do that, whatever that may be. And God is, I think we'll all agree, much better than Meatloaf. So, what is God like then? How are we to think about him? If we're going to move on beyond the sort of simplistic children's song, there's nothing that he cannot do, what are we to say about him? What is he like? Well, helpfully, John's already read Isaiah 40 for us, and I'd love us to turn back there if we could. I'd like to get you to do some work. So perhaps picking up in verse 12 onwards, just perhaps in your tables with the people sat around you, get yourselves into sort of groups of two or three, I guess, and have a look at Isaiah 40, 12 to the end, and ask these three questions together. Here we go. He poised to note the questions. First, what is God like? What is God like? Second, what does God know? And then thirdly, how does God know what God knows? Okay? What is God like? What does God know? How does God know what he knows? All right? So, why don't you spend a few minutes doing that, and then we'll feed back. Okay, let's feed back together. I have to say, I think you're the calmest group I've ever worked with. The sort of soft buzz of conversation was, very unusual. Right, so just from this passage, from Isaiah chapter 40, what can we say God is like? Unfathomable, thank you. All-knowing, great.
Holy.
Creator.
Above creation,
brilliant, thank you. Sits enthroned. Sorry, I missed that.
He has no equal.
Fantastic.
From the verses about the idols, futile for us to try and get to his level. I think we can equal.
Absolutely. Yeah, so without equal, kind of incomparable, that sort of thing. Yep.
Does not tire.
Very good. Thank you. Yes. Excellent. So, yeah, you know, his ways are far beyond us. Yeah. What, sorry?
He has a kind of a helicopter perspective when he looks down at the earth and looks like grasshoppers.
Yes. Absolutely. He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. Yeah.
He's triune.
Okay. Go on.
Well, the passage speaks of the Spirit of the Lord, and the context is, from the beginning of Isaiah 40, speaking of the one who's crying in the wilderness, John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Prophetically speaking of the Son who comes.
Yeah. Okay. I certainly think that, you know, looking back from the New Testament, you can certainly see, you know, aspects of that. Definitely. Yeah.
I'm just looking at verse 11 and seeing God's delightful ways, tenderness, and like a shepherd.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. There's another way of answering that question, though, isn't there? What is God like? Because I think, in one sense, that the whole point that Isaiah is making it in chapter 40, verses 12 and following, is God is not like anything, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole kind of rhetorical thrust of it. Who's held the waters in his hands? Answer expected, no one. Who's weighed the mountains like fine dust? No one, right? And actually, all the way through, God is completely different from anything we experience in the creation. There is this distinction between the creator and the created. So he's absolutely incomparable in terms of his scale. Just, you know, to him, the Atlantic and the Pacific and all the other piddly little oceans just fit in the palm of his hand. You know, the mountains, those symbols of strength and immovability, the very things that, you know, the biggest thing a human being can realistically imagine is a mountain. Okay, because that's the biggest thing you can kind of encounter and have a sense of its scale. Beyond that, you think you can imagine a galaxy or a universe, but I promise you, you can't. But a mountain, just about you can. At least if you've travelled outside the UK. you know, mountains are huge. And they're solid and they don't move. But actually, to God, they're lit dust. He's incomparable in terms of power. Rulers are nothing to him. He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth. He is on a whole nother level. In terms of his holiness, God is incomparable. I just think, the picture of altar fires in verse 16 is so striking, isn't it? So, you know, incomparable in terms of power. The nations are like a drop in a bucket. You know, the biggest superpower you like, it's nothing to him. And Lebanon is not sufficient for altar fires, nor its animals enough for burnt offerings. God's holiness is such, his glory, his wonder, is such that it is not possible for the whole creation to sort of band together and give him his due. So Lebanon, this, you know, we think of Lebanon as this sort of war-torn place, and that's probably for most of us what comes to mind. But Lebanon is a place of incredible fertility. My favourite wine is from Lebanon. I once said that in a sermon in a previous church, and then a member of the congregation kind of presented me with a bottle. It's not terribly cheap. Presented me with a bottle of it at Christmas, and I felt very ashamed of myself. But none of you are going to see me at Christmas. So, the cedar of Lebanon is this kind of image of the sort of the greatest of trees. And they're huge. In the 19th century, people used to sort of plant cedars of Lebanon in their sort of gardens. In my uncle's home in Wales, there's a cedar of Lebanon in the garden. And it's massive. You can kind of go for a walk round it pretty much. You know, and that's your daily exercise. That's an exaggeration. But it's a big old thing. And they're fragrant and beautiful, you know, at very desired wood. And get the best, the most expensive, the biggest trees you can imagine. Pile them up into a bonfire, reaching into the heavens, it feels like. That's the picture Isaiah's sort of describing, isn't it? All the cedars of Lebanon, all the trees of Lebanon, not enough for an altar fire. Take all the wild animals, take all the clean animals of that incredibly fertile region and sacrifice them all, and it's not enough. Because God is so unimaginably great, so holy. We couldn't begin to give him what is his due. It is not in us. He is so far beyond us. It is wonderful. He is incomparable on any scale you choose to measure him. And that includes, and we've kind of alluded to it already, that includes the idea of knowledge, doesn't it? What does God know? Simple answer? Everything. Okay. We see that, don't we, in terms of the stars. not only does he know every star, he knows the name of every star. But just imagine for a moment what that actually means. So within our galaxy, I'm informed that there are a similar number of stars to the number of grains of sand in the world, and that there are a similar number of galaxies. Now, in terms of feats of knowledge, I want you to think about this. Just imagine for a moment going down, imagine going down to the beach at Brighton. You won't get much sand there unless it's very low tide. But imagine a sandy beach, and you go to your sandy beach, or, you know, a kid's sandbox or whatever, with a teaspoon. And you get yourself a teaspoon of sand, and you get a sort of white sheet of paper, and you tip all the grains of sand onto that white sheet of paper. Now, if I asked you to name every single one of those grains of sand, you'd probably get quite bored and tired trying to fulfill the exercise, but I'm not actually going to ask you to do that, but I want to imagine doing that. There's a lot of grains of sand in a teaspoon. Imagine how many grains of sand there are on a beach. And then imagine how many beaches there are in the world, not to mention the deserts. And God has a name for every star. It's extraordinary, isn't it? And he knows it. He doesn't forget one, ever. Because if he did, it wouldn't be there. Because it only exists by his power. He calls them out one by one, says Isaiah. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Does that blow your mind? It jolly well ought to. When you think about God's knowledge, when you actually start to drill into what the Bible says about what God knows, it is actually almost becomes painful trying to imagine the extent of God's knowledge, let alone trying to imagine what it would be like to know like that. But if you go further, do we get any idea of how God knows what God knows?
It's not
learnt knowledge. Exactly. Say verse 13. My eyesight is just awful now. Who can fathom the spirit of the Lord or instruct the Lord as his counselor? Whom did the Lord consult him to enlighten him? Who taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? Answer expected. No one. No one has ever taught God anything. And that's all kinds of knowledge, isn't it? That's not just factual knowledge, but that's moral knowledge. Knowing the right way, knowing wisdom, knowing what is good, the path of understanding. God's knowledge is not learned, it's not received. We'll come back to that in a moment. But Isaiah's whole point is to contrast God with idols, isn't it? So, verse 18, with whom then will you compare God? To what image will you liken him? And then he basically starts a kind of satirical kind of, it's almost stand-up. He's sort of saying, okay, let's talk about idols, shall we? What are they like? Well, you know, your best hope for an idol is that it doesn't fall over. You know, and a really expensive one is cast in gold and then has silver chains to stop it toppling. And a person who can't present that sort of offering will just look for something, you know, made of wood that will not rot. Well, we've already thought about wood, haven't we? All the cedars of Lebanon, you know, not enough for altar fires to the Lord. You know, when you make an idol, you're trying to find wood that won't rot. Such a contrast between God and idols. He's totally incomparable. The basic distinction is the distinction between the creator and the created here. Nothing within the creation should be compared to God. The basic sin of idolatry is to take created things and treat them as if they were God, thereby telling lies about them and about God. Saying that God is comparable to this thing in the creation, that somehow this thing in the creation can be rated in some way alongside him. And Isaiah won't have it, and the scriptures won't have it for a moment. There are two kinds of thing that exist, and only two. And there are two kinds of, there are actually two kinds of people in the world. Those who believe that there are two kinds of thing that exist, and those that don't. That, by the way, is a sort of logical joke, which can be extended to say that there are 10 kinds of people in the world, those who understand binary and those who don't. But it is nonetheless the case, sorry, say 10 in binary is 2, right? But the point is that there are two kinds of things that exist, God and things that God has made. There is nothing else in existence. He is the uncreated creator of everything. And in many ways, the sort of heart lesson of the Old Testament, the lesson that the people of God took thousands of years to learn, was that God is not to be compared to the creation, to stop worshipping idols. To stop taking the created things and worshipping them as if they were the creator. You can get that distinction wrong, by the way, and think that the two kinds of things, you know, to think there are two kinds of things in existence, but to misname them, and that becomes very confusing and leads you astray. So it's just worth mentioning this at this point. So we can divide reality into two along the lines of natural and supernatural. That's sometimes how people think, particularly in kind of a Western culture that's become very naturalistic, is to think that anything that exists in any sort of supernatural realm is somehow on the plane of God's being, right? That's why we get very freaked out by supernatural things that go on. We can find ourselves thinking that there's this sort of cosmic struggle between God and Satan, or God and his angels against Satan and his minions, as if that's somehow an equal contest in the spiritual realm. It absolutely is not. Satan and all his minions owe their existence to the God who made them and who made them good, from which goodness they turned and became corrupt, as we have done. Okay, there are lots of supernatural beings that are not God. The basic distinction within reality is not the distinction between natural and supernatural. That's an artificial distinction that we've kind of imposed on reality. But in the view of life that the scriptures give us, that is not how, you know, the spiritual beings are just spoken of as being part of the creation. In some ways they have great power, but it is not power that is in any way comparable to God's power. It's an unseen reality, but the fact that it's unseen does not make it divine. Okay, so sometimes I think we find ourselves slipping into that way of thinking, and it can cause us unnecessary anxiety and distress when we see supernatural influence at work. We can fear that somehow, you know, God is unable to deal with it, or that somehow it's a sort of struggle for him, but it isn't. Nor is that line of kind of two kinds of thing, good things and evil things. Okay, so again, so a religion like Zoroastrianism has sort of two sort of basic forces, the light force and the dark force, that are in conflict, you know. And you know, it's quite common, that sort of view of reality in Eastern religions, you know, to some extent sort of yin and yang and that kind of thing. But again, that's not the view of reality that the Bible presents us with, as if, you know, things are inherently good or evil. God made everything good. And evil is, whilst it doesn't feel like it necessarily, is a kind of negation, is a kind of turning away from the good, or an absence of good where there should be good, just as darkness is an absence of light, which is why darkness is frequently the metaphor that is used for evil in the Bible. Because it's not a positive force, it doesn't have a being of its own. Evil is a kind of non-being, really. So when Adam and Eve turn away from God, there's a sort of evil that comes into humanity, not because God made something corrupt, God didn't make us bad, but we turned away from him. And it is in that turning away from him and turning in on ourselves that our, you know, that which is evil in humanity consists. Does that make sense? So, again, there's not some cosmic battle between good and evil going on at the highest level of reality out of which we're formed. The sort of Manichaean view of the world. That's not reality at all. Evil is just a corruption of what God made good and a turning away from him. The two kinds of thing that exist are God and things that God has made. And so anything that is not God owes its existence to him. And that is the sort of fundamental thing you need to know. If you want to say anything about God, you need to recognize that he is, in that sense, not like us. He belongs in a different category. He is the creator. And as such, is very different from us. Now, we can come on and talk about what it means then for us to be made in God's image later on, perhaps. But there is this fundamental unlikeness. And you see it, for instance, in his name, in Exodus chapter 3, verse 14. So let's just turn to Exodus 3 and think about that for a moment. Headings in our Bibles are interesting things, aren't they? Sometimes they're really helpful, and sometimes you think, I'm not sure you've quite got the point. Like this one, Moses and the burning bush. What's the one thing you know about the bush? It isn't burning, right? There are flames coming from within it, and Moses goes over to see this site. Why the bush does not burn up? Why is the bush not burning? That's the question in the background. When Moses is then confronted by God, who says, you're standing on holy ground, take off your sandals, introduces himself, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And, you know, we've talked about God's holiness. Here, verse 6, Moses is afraid. He hides his face. He's afraid to look at God. And God says, I've seen the misery of my people. And so I'm sending you. I've come down. I have come down to rescue them. And I'm sending you. Go to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And Moses says to God, verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? To which God, I think, basically says, come on, Moses, that's not really the right question, is it? That's essentially the thrust of verse 12, isn't it? God says, I will be with you. Maybe not all about you, Moses. I will be with you. This is the sign. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. And Moses says to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. It's a strange name, isn't it? I am who I am. But it tells us something about God's very nature. God is, in giving the covenant name to Moses, is revealing who he really is. That's what your name reveals you. To know someone's name is to know them, to know something about them, to know something really important and intimate about them. Which is why so many people hide their names online. But God, in giving Moses his name, says, I am. Why does he do that? Well, I suppose it points, doesn't it, to that idea we're talking about of God being the uncreated creator. No other thing in existence could say, I am who I am. Could point to themselves and say, I'm self-defined, I just am. You know, this man who stands in front of you right now, I have spent almost the entirety of history not existing. I'm really good at not being. It's my best skill. I came into existence. God did not come into existence. He was not made. He is. And that being, that living, is part of the definition of who he is. Living, in one sense, is not part of the definition of who I am. I was not, and but for the resurrection, there would be a time when I will not be. But with God, he is. And the way this is translated into Greek in the Septuagint is significant, because it uses this language, I am the living one, which is then picked up in Revelation chapter 1 on the lips of the Lord Jesus himself, when he says, you know, I am the living one. So it's with New Testament warrant that we say that the way that they translated this into Greek in exile in Egypt is actually a right understanding, that this means that living is part of the definition of who God is. He just is. He is not given his being by another, but life is part of the definition, is inherent to the idea of who God is. He just is. And theologians, writing in the days when Latin was the equivalent of English today, it was the sort of language that was spoken all around the world, which is why so many of our theological terms come from Latin. But they are sort of beautifully kind of condensed. And so I've put in the handout this word arseity, which literally just means sort of being from himselfness. So God comes from himself. He is arse, from himself, literally. And so he is self-defined and self-existent. He has no beginning. He was, he is, he will be. And nothing is given to him. Everything that he has from himself. And that leads on to this idea that God is the uncreated creator of all, leads on to what theologians call the idea of God's perfection. The idea that God is perfectly fulfilled in every good thing. He is the source of all good things, and so he is inherently, naturally, from himself, fulfilled in every good thing. That's what perfection means, completeness. It doesn't mean being flawless, although it does imply that, but actually it means completeness. God lacks nothing good. And to put it another way, there is no way you can improve on him. He has nothing to gain. He is who he is, and out of his goodness overflow all the goodnesses that we experience in the creation. All the good things that are created come from him and from his goodness. Now, when you think about that, that does quite a lot of things to you, I think. If you really meditate on that and you really focus on it, that every good thing that ever was or is or will be is a gift that overflows from the goodness of God. There is no goodness that doesn't come from him. There is no blessing that he is not ultimately responsible for. And as you think about that, you realize that there's no independence from him, is there? There is no life, there is no existence that he doesn't give. There's not one breath that you breathe, not one beat of your heart that you live independently of him, that he doesn't give to you as a gift. There is no good thing that you have ever experienced or ever will experience that is not completely a gift from him. I like to imagine my life, you know, I try not to, but, you know, it's easy to slip into imagining your life, isn't it, as being basically yours. and something that you do, and you maybe let God into bits of it, and maybe you're trying to let God into more of it. But a lot of the time we live heedless that every good thing we have is His, given to us for our enjoyment. I just think, if I take Exodus 3:14 seriously, I should be a much more joyful and thankful person than I am. I take so many things for granted, and I think of them as kind of natural blessings, as things belonging to the creation, and forget that the creation belongs to Him. Forget that the warmth of the sun is there only because He gives it. The fact that it rains so much in this country is the reason it's so green and pleasant. And that every drop of rain is a gift from Him. It's His world. Indeed, everything that exists, it's His universe. But in a deeper, more wonderful way than I think I often allow myself to imagine. So that's the first thing. I think, you know, worship, just as you work through the book of Revelation, you see there is, you know, the first scene of worship is worship of God for His wondrous work of creation. And I think I so often neglect that in my own devotion. You know, and then, you know, the next scene in the throne room of heaven is a new song and a song to the Lamb that was slain. We've got so much to thank God for, haven't we? But we'll come back to that. But actually, it's important for us to recognize and give thanks to God as our creator, and to honour Him as our creator and as the uncreated creator of everything. The other thing that goes with this is to recognise that the only person who can possibly give God a name is God Himself. I've heard so many times people say things like, I like to think of God as. Maybe we think of God like that sometimes. Or, I could never worship a God who. You know, Archbishop Desmond Tutu is very famous for saying, I would refuse to enter a homophobic heaven. I would not worship a homophobic God. Now, that's an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? You know, I will decide what kind of God I'm prepared to worship. Regardless of what might stand behind Tutu's statements and, you know, his concern for people made in the image of God, about whom he cares, and all the rest of it, actually, that is an extraordinary statement to make. I will decide what God can be like. I will decide whether to give Him permission to be this, that, or the other. And I will worship Him only on my terms. Now, it's not for me to pass judgment on Desmond Tutu, but that sounds to me like the language of an idolater, doesn't it? When you say, God, you're not allowed to disagree with me. Where we align, I'm in. But where you express yourself as having ideas that I don't accept, I'm not prepared to accept them. That's the language of idolatry. God is who He is. He chooses His own name. I don't get to say, well, look, God, this is who you are and this is what you're to be like. I can't do that. Only He can name Himself. Now, all of us have a name. Or most of us, at least, will have a name that's given to us by someone else. Now, occasionally, you know, for various reasons, people choose to change their own name by deed poll. But in general, I did not choose to be called Nicholas. I mean, I'm not angry about it. But, you know, it was given to me. It was imposed on me, if you like, by someone else. This is who you are. I think that's the significance of naming in baptism, isn't it? Of using a name in baptism. You know, it's an identity that's given to you. And baptism represents that identity that's given to you as a new creation in Jesus Christ. I think that's why kind of naming and baptism in the sort of Western world where P-Day baptism was the norm, that I think is why that happened. It's that sort of sense of, this is your identity, this is who you are. It's given to me. But in God, it is just who He is. So in terms of talking about perfection then, and that idea of God being perfect, I love this quote from Edward Lee, who was a Puritan writer, who said, God is absolutely and simply perfect because he hath all things which are to be desired for the chiefest felicity. Now, I'm aware that the chiefest felicity might sound like the sort of captain at the pony club, but it means that God is ultimately happy. He is the ultimately blessed one. He has everything within himself to be ultimately blessed, so he doesn't need anything. Which seems like quite a good point to end.